Welcome to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise McEntee, your host. And on Steppin' Out Radio, as most of you who are familiar with, but if you're a first-time listener, Steppin' Out Radio features true stories from people who have overcome so much adversity in their life, but yet triumphed over adversity. And oftentimes, the adversity manifests itself in an addiction or depression or PTSD, which is the bad news. But the good news is, when you hear these stories, they're people that really have experienced, I think, miracles and have, you know, not only overcome their issues, but are thriving. So today, I'm really excited to speak with a man who, when you read his bio, you'll be quite impressed. His name is Dr. Peter Grinspoon. He's a Harvard-trained medical doctor, and he's the author of a new riveting book called Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction. You could get it on Amazon. You could go to Dr. Grinspoon's website, which is www.petergrinspoon.com. And I'll spell Grinspoon, GRINSPOON.com. Dr. Grinspoon had a thriving practice, a medical practice, until a DEA one day walked into his office with a state police officer and arrested him. So obviously this story is riveting. Apparently, Dr. Grinspoon had been writing Vicodin prescriptions for his own use and using the name of a former nanny. But his story is so inspiring and eye-opening that you're not going to believe some of this shocking statistics also that he shares about what doctors go through in abusing prescription medicine. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Peter Grinspoon to Steppin' Out Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Grinspoon, your story, you know, I've had the privilege of having your book and reading it. But for those who haven't, usually on Steppin' Out, well, not usually, we always begin at the beginning. So what's your beginning? Like, what was your childhood like? What was your beginning?
Well, I grew up outside of Boston. My dad was a psychiatrist who was a huge advocate of legalizing marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a somewhat of an unusual background.
He was ahead of his time, right? Your dad was ahead of his time.
Yeah, he was ahead of his time, but the times are catching up with him, actually. I grew up with a lot of people like smoking pot in my upbringing, so it was definitely pretty unusual. And it was a very kind of intellectual household.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to Swarthmore College,
right,
and then taking 5 years off to work for Greenpeace, where I traveled all over the world.
Wow.
And then I went to medical school, where, as we'll discuss, I first got into trouble with prescription opiates.
Okay, but I'm going to bring you back to your earlier days. So you said it was kind of like a free environment, which is, you know, maybe not the norm back then. But did both your parents smoke pot? Did all of their friends? Did they let you smoke it at a young age?
Well, they definitely didn't let us smoke it. Though, of course, we snuck it from them and smoked it all the time,
right,
starting at age 12.
Okay.
But, kids often do what parents do. But my dad smoked it, and he was a big advocate of legalizing it, not just for medical use, but for recreational use. He thought it was a lot safer than alcohol,
mm-hmm,
and that it's much worse for people to be arrested for marijuana possession than to actually use marijuana.
Right, and he was correct, as we hear, you know,
yeah,
story after story, really. But okay, so your childhood, though, was typical, I'm assuming, right? I mean, a little bit different in that your parents were into intellects, like you said, and maybe that was different. But, you know, did you have any problems in your middle school, high school years with substances?
Well, I was definitely like a young stoner, mm-hmm, but I also had really good grades and I had a good social life.
Okay.
So it didn't really seem to impact me that much.
Right. So your friends were stoners too, I'm assuming.
Yeah, some of them. Some of them were like, you know, we were in a band. So yeah, a lot of them were stoners.
Okay. So you were in the band and then you, the same thing, I'm assuming, through high school, did you play sports or no? Or you just...
No sports, mostly music.
Music. Okay. So then high school was over and you went to college or took 5 years off first?
Oh, no, I went right to college, and I went to Swarthmore College,
okay, right,
where I majored as impractically as I could in philosophy.
Okay. Well, that's not easy major, though. Okay, so that was over, and then you said you went to Greenpeace, was it?
Yeah, I worked for Greenpeace for 5 years, where I got to travel all over the world.
And so up until this point, nothing's really been a problem, just smoking pot and whatever?
Yeah, exactly. Nothing nothing out of the ordinary.
So no one, like, said, we smoke pot, but Peter, I don't know, he does it more than us, or he likes it more than us, or he's more obsessed with it.
No, I was pretty much, you know, I definitely, like, a lot of my friends did smoke pot, but I wasn't out of the norm for my peer group.
Got it. Okay. Were you able to smoke through the traveling years at Greenpeace?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Greenpeace was not necessarily discouraging of casual marijuana use.
Okay. So then after 5 years, you graduated from that program, and I'm assuming you have your bachelor's degree at this point. Then what happened next?
Well, I applied to medical school and got into Boston University School of Medicine, so I came back to Boston.
Okay. Did you, was it a burning desire, or was it because your dad was a doctor, or you just...
It was something that I always thought I was destined to do, but I wasn't in a particular hurry to do.
Got it. Okay. So you went to BU, and I guess you studied hard, and was there a lot of smoking pot then, or not really?
Not much. A couple people, but it was much more of a... straight-laced crowd, obviously, than Greenpeace. I mean, going from Greenpeace to medical school
right. Is
really a big cultural shift. I mean, people partied a lot, but they just drank a lot as opposed to smoking a lot.
I was just going to ask you that. Were you a drinker?
I was not a drinker. I've never been much of a drinker.
Okay.
I'm not against it. It doesn't do
right,
much for me.
It's not your drug of choice. So then, did you ever dabble in any other drugs, or was it strictly pot?
Well, I dabbled in everything at some point.
Okay.
You know, I tried hallucinogens. In college, I tried ecstasy. So I definitely was a dabbler, which was, as we'll get to, which is kind of the problem, because if you dabble enough, at some point you're going to run into something that you like a little bit too much.
Sure. Okay, so then you were in BU, and we know you graduated, and what happened next?
Well, it was in my third year of medical student school that I was introduced to Vicodin.
Ooh.
And we were reading about it. Me and a classmate and I were reading about it. And it said, warning, causes severe euphoria and a false sense of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And once we read that, we were destined to try it.
Oh, really?
And then once we tried, it seemed like it made it sound very interesting. And once we tried it, it made me so euphoric that I literally spent the next 10 years trying to recreate an initial high with any opiates that I could find.
Okay, so how did you get the first opiate? Was it easy because doctors gave it to you? Were you able at that point to prescribe it to each other? Or?
Well, I was still a medical student, so we couldn't prescribe it, but there were samples all over the place.
Okay.
And as it turned out, I was dating another medical student, and her dad was a doctor, and he gave us a big box of medical supplies.
Huh.
As kind of a care package for her to bring back to medical school.
Oh,
just like other people would give a care package of, like, food.
Right.
And so we had all these pills that we were sifting through, and it was the Vicodin that caught our attention.
And you both tried it at the same time?
Yeah, we both tried it at the same time, but I think it affected me more than it affected my friend.
So it was a she, right?
Yeah, it was a she.
So she never got caught up in it, as far as you know?
No, she enjoyed it and found it pleasurable, but didn't spend the next 10 years trying to recreate it.
Right. Okay, so you started it, and was it easy? I mean, I know you wanted to keep creating that euphoria. Was it easy to get your hands on more opiates?
Well, it was easy. Easier as your addiction progressed and as I kind of lowered my standards to what was acceptable behavior. I mean, with addiction, it always progresses.
So explain what you would do.
Yeah, I started stealing it from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I would even steal it from patients.
Uh-huh.
I would steal it from relatives' houses.
Okay.
And I would get people to prescribe it for me. You know, doctors tend to give each other professional courtesy.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with this story about having these really bad migraines.
Mm-hmm.
And people would pretty much freely prescribe me Vicodin if I asked for it.
Really? Did anyone ever say, or did you ask so many doctors that no one's, you know, antenna went up?
Well, I asked a lot of different doctors to avoid exactly that kind of scrutiny. But I think people were starting to get suspicious as the years went on.
Now, were you able to function? Were you stoned out? Were you? Was it hard to study? Was it hard to do your rounds? Was it?
Well, I only took the medications at night.
Okay.
But I was taking first 10, and then first 5, and then 10, and then 15, and then like 20 Vicodin at night. So I was pretty wasted at night.
So but that was like day, having a couple of drinks to you. But when you went to work, you were straight.
Yeah, I was the definition of a high-functioning opiate addict. I mean, I really was functioning at work, and I was attending to my studies because I have a pretty good work ethic.
Sure.
But again, it's only a matter of time because addiction takes away everything. And I think if I had kept going without getting help, I think at some point it would have really affected my work.
Right. So, okay, so you're taking it at night. When did it... Okay, so you eventually, I'm assuming, graduated med school, right?
Absolutely.
And you become a doctor. Now, what did you practice? What kind of medicine?
Well, I was a resident in primary care internal medicine.
Okay.
So I was sort of learning how to be a jack of all trades, but master of none.
Okay. So when did it cross over? Well, let me back up a little bit. What was your personal life like? Did you get married? Did you have girlfriends? Did you...
Yeah, well, I had girlfriends, and then I got married. I was actually just, I was in just a horrible marriage. I'm now currently very happily remarried, and I'm sort of in the exact opposite extreme of where I was 15 years ago. But I just picked a really bad marriage. You can wonder whether I was so drugged out that I wasn't making good choices.
Right. Was she in the field?
Bad luck.
Was she in the field?
No, she was in a totally different field.
Okay.
But I certainly, you know, you can never blame your addiction on another person. But in addition to being a doctor and learning how to be a doctor and being very stressed out by that, I was in a very stressful home situation. So really, no matter where I went, home, work, I would be pretty stressed out. So
do you think it was chicken egg, though? Like, do you think if you weren't doing drugs, maybe you're... relationship would have been okay, or you just feel like, nope, it was not the right choice?
Oh, yeah, no, the marriage was just a disaster because when I got off drugs, it was just as bad.
Okay.
You know, that was like the million-dollar question. How much does my addiction contribute to this dysfunctional marriage? And the answer was, get off drugs and see if it gets any better, and it didn't get any better.
So now, was she aware of your drug issues?
She was increasingly aware as the years went by.
Oh, so you stayed married a long time.
Yeah, we were married for about 8 years.
Did you have kids with her?
Yeah, we had two little kids at the time when all this went down.
So that was stressful too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you have a bad marriage, an increasing addiction, two young kids. And did you go to in your own practice, or were you in a hospital setting?
I was in my own practice, which was in the hospital. So I had the best of both worlds.
Got it. Okay. So... life is going on. You're doing it at night only. When did you cross over and start maybe doing it during the day and, you know, or did it never cross over?
I never crossed over that line. But again, it was only a matter of time. I'm sure that would have happened, which is why it's so lucky that I got in trouble when I did, which forced me to get help when I did. But, you know, I was doing it at night, but I was pretty brain dead the next day. I mean, I would stay up later and later, and I would be taking more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I would be really spaced out and nauseous and withdrawing and anxious and preoccupied with obtaining more opiates. So I was definitely by no means at my best as a doctor.
Now, was opiate the only drug you took, or did you take like tranquilizers because you were shaky from the way you felt?
Yes, all of the above. But opiates were the thing that got me in trouble. And I would say that opiates were the thing I was mostly addicted to, but I was definitely... also addicted to benzos, and I was smoking marijuana all the time, and I was really anything I could get my hands on, I would take.
Now, who gave you the benzos? The same doctors that gave you the Vicodin?
No, I actually saw a psychiatrist.
Oh, okay.
And she was a wonderful psychiatrist, but she gave me way too many benzos, and she somehow didn't see the addiction, even though it was sort of increasingly obvious.
Now, did she know about your problem with Vicodin? Is that why you went to her? You went to her for your marriage? Or did you ever bring up the topic?
I went for just anxiety and depression. And she knew about the marriage, and she helped me with that. But she didn't know about the Vicodin. Until the end. Toward the end, she absolutely knew about the Vicodin.
Because you shared it with her, or she was suspicious of how you were acting or looking?
I shared it with her, and she was trying to help our marriage. So she was meeting with me and my wife. And my wife really thought that was the main problem. It was obviously a big problem. My wife thought that was, like, the problem with our marriage. So she brought the addiction up a lot in extreme detail during our therapy sessions.
Wow. Did you? So you saw each other, you saw the therapist separately, but also together?
Correct.
Okay. So, all right. So obviously you got divorced. So unfortunately or fortunately, that didn't work. So we're going to find out because something happened that really made you have to stop, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, and we're going to find that out. You're listening to Steppin' Out Radio, True Stories of Addiction and Recovery. I'm Denise McEntee, your host, and I have with me today Dr. Peter Grinspoon, who is a Harvard-trained medical doctor, and he's author of this book that you're hearing, and this is what's in the book, a lot of his story, and it's called Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction. But there's lots more in the book, too, that you know, obviously we can't get to here, so I urge you to get the book. You can go to www.petergrinspoon.com, and you'll be able to find out everything about the book. I'm sure it's, you know, obviously you can get it on Amazon and all the other places where you get books. And if you want to check out other stories like Dr. Grinspoon, you can go to our website, steppingoutradio.com, www.steppingoutradio.com. Sign up for our free newsletter. And like I said, check out stories. You know, their stories run the gamut from celebrities to sports figures to doctors to lawyers to just about everybody. And one more thing, we also really excited to announce that we have a new mobile app. And it's available for iTunes and Android. And it's steppingoutradio.com. It's free. It's amazing. All these stories are on it. So if it's late at night and you want to hear an uplifting story, or if it's, you know, or if you want your friend to listen to it because you think they might have a problem, or you just want to hear great stories, check it out. You just joined us. Dr. Grinspoon was saying that something caused him to stop. So what happened next?
Well, I was coming back from a noon lecture during one of my busiest days in my primary care clinic, and waiting for me in my office were two gentlemen, one from the DEA and one from the state police.
Oh, gosh.
And I was just absolutely flabbergasted to see them there, even though deep down I knew that I was breaking the law. And I started kind of trying to explain away their visit. Mm-hmm. The DEA agent said to me, "Doc, cut the crap. We know you've been writing bad scripts."
Wow.
And they proceeded to sort of interrogate me, and they invited me to the police office the next morning to formally receive three felony charges of fraudulently prescribing a controlled substance and to get my fingerprints taken.
You must have been terrified, huh?
I was absolutely terrified, and a very, very small part of me was sort of relieved that hopefully this is all going to end.
Hmm.
But mostly I was angry and I was terrified.
And blindsided, I'm assuming? Like you thought you were covering up, you know, good enough that you weren't going to get caught, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. I thought I was smarter than everybody and there was no way I was going to get caught.
Right.
I was completely blindsided.
Okay, so that must have been awful. So were you put in a jail cell and someone had to bail you out, or how did that work?
Well, no, they treated me like an adult because I was a doctor and I had a clean record.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to come on my own to the police station to get fingerprinted.
Okay.
But then there were some pretty major criminal charges, and I ended up having to go through the court system for the criminal charges, and I ended up on probation for 2 years, which means that if I didn't do everything my probation officer said, I would get surrendered to the judge, and I could get in a lot of trouble, possibly even go to jail.
Now, did the hospital know what happened? I mean, assuming they showed up there. Did you lose your license immediately?
Well, the hospital dropped me, but they had to. I don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
I was like this scary, out-of-control, unknown thing. And, you know, they're just trying to, like, have a quiet, you know, productive environment. I totally didn't fit into that. But I was given a chance by the medical board. But unfortunately, the minute you get caught isn't the minute you enter recovery. So I started flunking drug tests.
Wow.
And after that, it wasn't very long until the medical board pulled my license. And it was a total of 3.5 years that I was out of work.
Okay, so they pulled your license. Did your probation officer know? Like, how did you wind up not getting in trouble from him or her?
Well, the thing about my probation officer is her attitude was, if I hear about it from you first, I won't necessarily surrender you to the judge.
Oh, okay.
So I maintained open communication with her. And also, she was savvy enough to know that people don't get immediately transitioned from addiction to recovery. They often have slips.
Right.
So while her patience wasn't infinite, she didn't turn me in the first time or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty soon after that, I got my act together.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you had to leave for 3.5 years. I'm sure that was devastating. And
yeah, it was awful.
And so that, you know, you no income, I'm assuming, and all that other stuff. So what happened that you finally got it? Like, did you go to meetings? Did you go away for rehab? What happened?
Well, I was drug tested a ton,
mm-hmm.
and which means I couldn't really cheat. I was taking really sophisticated drug tests that they give to doctors who are good at cheating drug tests.
Right.
So after a while, you just kind of get out of the habit of using drugs to manage all your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to a lot of support group meetings, which were really helpful, both physician support group meetings and Narcotics Anonymous meetings.
Oh, good.
And I had a lot of counseling and a lot of therapy. And I think that all those things together helped me slowly figure out how to manage my life without always being high.
Now, what did counseling help you with? Just figuring out why you did this, or, you know, paint the picture of how it helped you?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big trigger for me was loneliness. And I think a lot of that, and I go into this in more detail in Free Refills, was that I lost a brother to cancer when I was very young.
Sorry.
And I never felt like I was not lonely. And I think a big part of my addiction was sort of medicating that away. But, you know, the irony is that there always have been and are a lot of people in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't feel like there were a lot of people in my life. And I think the counseling helped me open up to letting people in so that I wouldn't feel lonely and I wouldn't be triggered to take as many drugs.
Right. Because even though... Well, what is it? You know, you could be in a crowded room, but you still could feel alone, right? So,
absolutely. And as a doctor, especially, because you're dealing with people like nonstop, and you're so talked out by the end of the day. But a lot of it is not like a personal relationship; it's a professional relationship,
right? And you have to almost show yourself as this godlike figure, you know, or not godlike, but you know what I mean, like.
Absolutely. It is
right.
Sort of got like invulnerable and efficient.
Exactly. So what did you get from the meetings with the other doctors? Just support, I'm assuming, and how they got through it?
Right. I mean, a lot of practical information, like how to survive the medical board, which isn't very user-friendly to doctors who are on drugs, but also just a lot of inspiration. I mean, I saw a lot of people really turn their lives around, starting in even more desperate circumstances than I was in, even though at the time I didn't really think that was possible.
Mm.
And it was just very inspiring to see, essentially, that if you do stop, if you do find a way to stop using drugs, you probably will be given a second chance.
Now, what were your triggers, though? Was it hard at night because that's when you usually did it? Like, did you change your behaviors at night, like go to the gym or, you know?
Yeah, I would say my triggers were being happy, sad, lonely. Everything was a trigger. I mean, I was just, the drugs were so integrated into how I was dealing with the world that
right.
being sad and being lonely were triggers, but boredom was a big trigger too.
Well, they
and
say it's like a warm blanket too, right? People talk
yeah,
about it being like, you know, a friend, a warm blanket.
Yeah, absolutely. But you use drugs to treat boredom. And the problem is then everything is boring when you're not doing drugs.
Right.
So
ooh,
sort
right.
Of self-
good point.
Perpetuating.
Right. So how did you alleviate your boredom?
Well, I started going to the gym, and I think the endorphins actually really helped. And
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of literature that people who are recovering from addiction tend to gravitate towards the gym because it gives them a lot of the same feelings, but in a much positive, more positive way of expressing them. So I went to the gym, and I really went to support group meetings, And I just really tried my hardest to let people in.
Now, when you went to the gym, did you do, you know, cardio? Were you hesitant at first? Were you not a gym person so that I was like, oh, I got to do this now? Or were you just open to it?
Well, when I was in rehab, and they made me go to rehab for 90 days.
Oh, you did go to rehab. Okay.
Yeah, 90 days away from my family. The other guys there, it was in the South, so they were definitely the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all lifting weights. And the minute I started lifting weights, I became completely addicted to that.
Okay, a healthy addiction, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what happened in rehab? I guess you learned a lot about yourself too, right?
I did. I had great group therapy in rehab. I had a great therapist and great colleagues in group therapy. I have to say that huge portions of rehab are a total scam, and they're just fluff, and they're a complete waste of time.
Wow.
But there was enough of it that was positive and helpful that I think it really did nudge me towards recovery.
And the positive and helpful were the group talks, the letting people in?
The group talks and the solidarity.
Hmm. But yet you said you were lonely, but yet, I'm just trying to paint the picture here. Even though you said you were lonely, but yet you liked the solidarity. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, it was just, you know, I was off drugs and I was just start learning how to let people in. And I was in this place for 90 days with some really cool people that had a lot, that I had a lot in common with.
Mm-hmm.
They were all just, they just all had their crutch taken away, like I, my crutch taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways it was a very wonderful environment to be in early recovery. Early recovery can be really discouraging because, as I mentioned, you don't have your crutch anymore.
Right.
And you've made a shambles of your life. But it was really helpful to be with other people in the same boat. I guess maybe misery loves company, but I found it really inspiring that all of these colleagues had been through the same thing and were working as hard as I was to get their lives together.
Sure, and you don't feel as alone. You're listening to Steppin' Out Radio. Welcome back. I'm Denise McEntee, your host. And Steppin' Out Radio, for those who are just joining us, is two stories of people that have triumphed over addiction. Usually it's addiction. And our guest is no different. He's Dr. Peter Grinspoon, and he is really, his story is so amazing because he's a Harvard-trained medical doctor. And oftentimes you think doctors are godlike, because they are, and how can they, you know, get addicted? But he did, and that's where we left off. He was in rehab, and he found strength and comfort in the other people and the stories. But what happened next when you got out? Like, is that when your marriage split up? What did you do for 3.5 years for a job? And, you know, fill us in on that.
Well, for 3.5 years, I was writing my book because I didn't have anything else to do.
Well, that's
good. Because
I
couldn't get any work.
Oy.
But I thought that was a productive way to go.
It sure is.
And, you know, I was really wondering how much the addiction was responsible for my marital problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to my marriage clean and sober, and my marriage actually got worse when I wasn't on drugs because it was all the flaws were a lot more clear for me to see.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up getting divorced.
Okay.
But as I mentioned before, I'm very, very happily remarried. And once I was back, I started, I was taking a lot of drug tests. I was going to a lot of support group meetings, and I started the long process of trying to convince a very skeptical medical board to give me a second chance.
Wow. And that after the 3.5 years or during that 3.5 year period?
Well, during the 3.5 years, but they wanted to see at least a couple years of negative drug tests.
Okay.
Because they were very skeptical of me.
And you showed them that, obviously.
Yeah, and, you know, I really genuinely worked through a lot of the things that were causing me to take drugs in the first place.
Right, so eventually you were reinstated, right?
Yes, they did it sort of gradually. I still was monitored, I was drug tested, and for the first year or so, I wasn't allowed to prescribe anything stronger than penicillin.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you came back, I'm just going to be blunt because of the stigma of addiction, and you talk about that too. Did you feel like a pariah? Did people treat you like one? Did people not want to go to you because they heard, or how did that work?
Well, I felt like a pariah, but people actually treated me really well. The other doctors that I work with are incredibly cool and supportive of this. And honestly, my patients at this practice are very down and out. It's an inner city practice. A lot of them don't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them can't read. And mm-hmm. I think only a very few of them even knew about my addiction. And a few of them talked to me about it. And we had a good talk about it. And they were like, well, you're a good doctor. You know, it doesn't matter to me what you did in the past.
Sure.
So I don't think I lost any patients. But, yeah, getting over the guilt and the shame was a huge, huge component of feeling good about myself.
Right, but you did that too, which is amazing. So tell us what your life is like now in sobriety for the last 9 years. And if you could share with us, because this was an eye-opener for me when I read in your book, 69% of doctors have abused prescription medicine. Can you share with us, you know, then what your work went on to do with other doctors?
Yeah, I worked for the same group that helped me, the Physician Health Services. But instead of being the one drug tested and monitored, I was monitoring and drug testing other doctors and trying to inspire them and support them enough so that they could make the transition from addiction to recovery. I mean, being a doctor is like a perfect storm for addiction because of all the stress you have and because of the access to medications. So it's actually fairly common, addiction in doctors. It's estimated to be more common than in the general population. And I was very privileged to have a chance for 2 years to work with these physicians and help them try to turn it all around.
That's amazing. And I heard they say lawyers too. You know, we read up a lot about it here at the radio show that lawyers have a high percentage, higher than norm percentage as well.
Yeah, they have a very high percentage of alcoholism.
Yeah, it's stressful
too.
Something
like 20-25%.
Right. It's, I guess it's the stress and, you know, the overachieving too. And it's, you know, it's not easy. But all right. So I just wanted to, again, and you're listening to Dr. Peter Grinspoon, who wrote the book that we were talking about, Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction. And in the book, you know, because I think it's important for people to know that there, you know, there is a problem in any doctors out there listening or, you know, friends and family of doctors, that if you suspect there's a problem, you know, there is ways to get help. But why do you think few doctors ever do seek help, even though they understand the damage their addiction can have on themselves and their patients and their career?
Well, it's not just doctors, it's nurses and pharmacists and physician's assistants, and dentists. All healthcare providers are afflicted by this. The problem is the help is so punitive that most people won't get it unless, in my case, they're actually forced to.
Mm.
You could lose your license, you can lose your livelihood, you get knocked up your pedestal, you get sort of criticized and stigmatized. So most people, unfortunately, don't get help until they're absolutely forced to.
Right. So the doctors that you work with obviously are in that recovery. But what are the harsh legal consequences? Is that why? Because, you know, when they're confronted with addiction, there can be some harsh, you know, legal consequences, right?
Yeah, certainly you can get sued by a patient. I had committed criminal offenses procuring medications.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people steal. I mean, when you're an addict, you're desperate. And
right.
You do really, really dumb things. Or things that aren't dumb at the time, but in retrospect, are awful. And, you know, the chickens come home to roost. And it's so much easier just to deny that you have a problem and to just hope you won't get caught than to sort of surrender yourself to all this trouble you can get in.
Like Nurse Jackie, did you ever watch that show?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, and like, okay, so there's stigma all around us. It's not just in the medical field. I mean, if you do a Google search even of, you know, CEOs maybe in recovery or whatever, very little, if anything, will come up. Yet we know that there's many CEOs, you know, in recovery. Why do you think, I shouldn't even say why, because we, well, if you're like me and you, we know why to destigmatize it. But how can you destigmatize it, you know, in the health community, in the medical community?
Well, I'm hoping that writing Free Refills helps. Because I'm hoping that if people read the story of like a friendly, successful primary care doctor who manages to get head over heels addicted to prescription opiates, they can realize that anybody can get addicted. And I think as we're in the middle of this epidemic of opiate addiction, people are understanding that it's not just you know, other people. It's their own relatives and friends. So I'm hoping that the more we stimulate discussion about these issues and about the fact that opiate addiction isn't necessarily a death sentence. People can recover if you support them, love them, and care about them, and don't give up on them. They can recover. And I think as we get these messages out and we start treating addiction less as a moral failing that needs to be punished and more as a disease that requires treatment and empathy, I think the stigma is going to continue to crumble.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Good. And I think it is actually crumbling somewhat. So much more
slowly
so
but
that,
surely. Yeah. Some places faster than others.
Right. Because when we did this show, we've been doing this show now for, you know, many years. And I've, you know, all of us here have definitely seen a change. And before you leave, and I could talk to you for another hour, but before you leave, I'd like to know, how can doctors seek help for addiction without fear of professional ruin? Like, what would you say to a doctor out there listening or a health care professional?
Well, I would say be honest with yourself. And if you, when you're honest with yourself, if you have a problem, you have to get it treated because it's going to take everything from you. And maybe you could, for example, sign yourself up for a program or contract with an addiction psychiatrist and start working privately on your problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people recover that way and they don't have to go through the public shame and humiliation and meltdown that I went through.
Right, right, exactly. So if you, you know, or you could reach out to somebody, you know, go to a meeting, you know, it's anonymous. And, you know, you could, if somebody asks you and you don't want to talk, for those of you that have never been to a meeting, you don't have to, you know, you can just say, I'm just here to listen and learn and, you know, whatever. So there is help. And I agree. Don't let it get to the point where, like you, unfortunately, the DEA is knocking at the door, right?
Absolutely. Because the addiction is going to get taken care of. The question is whether you take care of it kind of in a healthy way or whether it catches up with you.
And now you're sober 9 years, right?
Yeah, I'm back at work for 8 years and sober for 9 years.
How's that feel?
Oh, it feels wonderful. It's like having a second, it's like having a second lease on life.
You sound really, really upbeat and, you know, positive for the future. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Dr. Peter Grinspoon, a Harvard-trained medical doctor and the author of the book Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction. I urge you to get the book. I urge you to check out his website, which is www.petergrinspoon.com. I'll spell Grinspoon, GRINSPOON.com. You'll learn a lot. Get the book. You'll learn so many things that were eye-opening to me. But again, as we do every week, the show ends on a hopeful note, and there is hope. So, you know, never give up. So thanks for being with us.
Pleasure speaking with you.
Take care.